Pat Mines, a terrorist attack targeting a bus in Syria's eastern province of Rafah kills at least 11 military personnel and injures several more. Iran says a deal on the revival of the JCPOA is possible if the U.S. accepts that it should lift all sanctions imposed on Iran. Latin American leaders welcome the election of Gustavo Petro as Colombia's first ever leftist president. Hello and welcome everybody. In Syria, a terrorist attack on a civilian transit bus kills at least 13 people and injures three, most of them government troops. Syria's defense ministry says the attack happened in the province of Raqqa on a road linking the city of Raqqa to Homs. The ministry says 11 troops and two civilians were killed in the attack. It said another three soldiers were wounded. There is no claim of responsibility yet. The region was once controlled by Daesh terrorists. The group's sleeper cells have carried out similar attacks over the past months, leaving dozens dead or wounded. Bahrain has officially set up a full diplomatic mission in Syria over a decade after its last ambassador left the country. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad received the credentials of Ambassador Wahid Mubarak Sayyar in an official ceremony on Sunday. Sayyar was appointed in December, 4 years after Bahrain reopened its embassy in Damascus. Bahrain and the UAE have tried to normalize ties with Syria after they cut ties with Damascus in the wake of the war that broke out in 2011. The conflict, fueled by some of their allies, has left hundreds of thousands of Syrians dead. June 20th marks World Refugee Day. For Palestinians, the day is an occasion to review a history of displacement, dispossession, and suffering under Israeli occupation. We were earlier joined by our Gaza correspondent, Asher Shannon, to get a picture of the situation of displaced Palestinians.
World Refugee Day is another reminder for the world about the suffering of refugees in general and Palestinians in particular. They've been displaced and dispossessed for more than 74 years. On May 15th, Palestinians marked the 74th anniversary of Nakba Day, of the catastrophe, referring to the displacement, disposition, and massacre of Palestinians in 1948 upon the creation of the Israeli regime. Currently, there are 6 million registered Palestine refugees around the world, according to UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees. But Palestinians say that the number is much higher because not all Palestinian refugees and their descendants have been registered with UNRWA. Gaza is home to more than 1.3 million Palestinian refugees out of a population of nearly 2 million. The suffering is much higher in Gaza. They've been under blockade since 2007. They have faced four Israeli wars since 2008.
Iran blames the U.S. for stalled talks to revive the JCPOA, saying the administration of President Joe Biden is pursuing the failed policy of its predecessor. Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh says the U.S. is responsible for the current situation surrounding the JCPOA, as it was Washington that withdrew from the accord in 2018 and did its best to destroy the pact. The spokesman said Tehran recently came up with an initiative to help the talks move forward, but the U.S. decided to push for an anti-Iran resolution by the UN Nuclear Watchdog's Board of Governors, aiming to gain leverage in the talks. Khatibzadeh said Tehran is still prepared to finalize a deal if Washington stops efforts to keep parts of the so-called maximum pressure campaign and lift all anti-Iran sanctions. President of the Republic of Kazakhstan, Qasim Jomart Tokayev, has paid a visit to Iran to cement ties with the Islamic Republic. Yusuf Jalali reports from the Iranian capital.
A warm welcome for a new chapter in the Iran-Kazakhstan relations. On Sunday, Kazakh President Qasim Jomart Tokayev arrived in Tehran at the invitation of his Iranian counterpart, Ebrahim Raisi. After an hour-long meeting, the two sides oversaw the signing of several cooperation documents on transport, energy, and tourism, among other areas.
Despite the existing geopolitical situation and restrictions, Kazakhstan and Iran managed to increase their bilateral trade by 50% over the past 3 months. With today's MOUs, I'm certain that we will achieve a lot more in our interactions.
Iran was the first country that recognized Kazakhstan's independence following the dissolution of the Soviet Union in 1991. That was when Tehran and Nur-Sultan began their diplomatic ties. President Raisi says the two nations have never been closer.
This visit by the honorable Kazakh president is undoubtedly a milestone in Iran-Kazakhstan relations. Over the past 30 years, we have maintained fraternal ties with our neighbor, Kazakhstan, but the level of our relations need to be enhanced.
Iran and Kazakhstan are both members of the Economic Cooperation Organization, ECO. This provides a safe trading channel for the two countries, without worries over the impacts of U.S. sanctions on Iran.
We need to expand our cooperation through regional organizations such as the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and the Eurasian Economic Union.
Since he took office less than a year ago, President Raisi has been trying to establish closer neighborly ties, as he believes this would obviate the need for Iran to wait for the fate of the ailing 2015 deal with the world powers to improve its economy.
Before the coronavirus pandemic, Iran and Kazakhstan's annual trade exceeded $1 billion. But the pandemic pushed this figure down to around $200 million. Today, the two presidents vowed to push the envelope of their country's commercial interaction and set a $3 billion mark for their annual trade. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Latin American leaders have welcomed the election of Gustavo Petro as Colombia's first leftist president. In 50 years, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro said Petro's election puts Colombia on the path to democracy and peace. Argentine President Alberto Fernandez also said the win paves the way to maximum solidarity in Latin America. Similar messages of unity were relayed by leaders of Bolivia, Chile, and Mexico. Petro won the presidency on the promise of bringing about profound social and economic changes in Colombia. He won 50.5% of the votes. He will succeed the unpopular conservative Iván Duque, who was barred by Colombia's constitution from running for re-election. Our correspondent Camila Escalante says the Colombian president-elect is very likely to cause a major shift in the country's foreign policy.
But we will see definitely a change of direction, because this coalition, the Pacto Histórico, that has elected and brought into power Gustavo Petro, has not seen eye to eye with the government of Iván Duque on many issues. So we're seeing a completely different vision that they've been promoting throughout this campaign, a different vision on how to interact with the United States, with Washington, a different vision on how to go about the implementation of the peace accords, and how to go about responding to the human rights crisis and the high levels of violence and drug trafficking and other crime that we see in Colombia. So right now, what we are waiting for is for the president-elect to come out and speak to these huge crowds of supporters. There are celebrations taking place all across Colombia right now. Right off the bat, we heard some of these progressive and leftist leaders from around our continent come out on social media to extend their congratulations to Gustavo Petro and Francia Marquez. That includes President Nicolas Maduro, President of Venezuela, as well as Luis Arce of Bolivia, Miguel Díaz-Canel, the President of Cuba, and many, many others have extended their congratulations and have said that they look forward to building a more integrated, peaceful region now with this new government.
Lawmakers in the United States remain divided on reaching a deal on gun safety as pressure mounts to reduce gun violence following two mass shootings last month. Utah Republican Senator Mike Lee said after asking to see the textual content of a potential agreement, it became apparent that, quote, there still is no deal. He said a bipartisan group of lawmakers have an agreement on a series of, quote, very broad promises. Lee also called for additional, quote, transparency to deal with the controversial matter. Last week, the lead Republican negotiator in the Senate tasked with crafting a gun safety bill walked out of the talks. This against the backdrop of a Texas elementary school shooting in May, when 19 children and two teachers were killed. Another gunman at a New York supermarket killed 10 black people. And the final results of France's parliamentary election show President Emmanuel Macron's alliance lost its absolute majority. Full vote count results published by the Interior Ministry show Macron's alliance has won 245 seats in the 577-member parliament. That means the alliance is well short of the 289 seats needed for an overall majority. The left-wing NUPES coalition, which is led by leftist politician Jean-Luc Mélenchon, has won 135 seats. Addressing his supporters, Mélenchon said the vote results were, quote, totally unexpected and unseen. He added his camp succeeded in its goal to deprive Macron of his parliamentary majority. Finally, far-right leader Marine Le Pen's National Rally Party has managed to send 89 MPs to the National Assembly. Soaring inflation creating troubles worldwide. In Britain, the railway network is going to take its biggest strike action in over three decades over a pay row. A British rail union says more than 50,000 workers will take part in a three-day national strike. The union argues the strikes are necessary as wages have failed to keep pace with inflation, which has hit a 40-year high. The British government and the union were engaged in a war of words over the weekend. The union's leaders said no viable settlements had been found to the disputes, with the country's transport secretary accused union leaders of refusing to meet for further talks. Countries around the world are being hit by decades-high inflation as the Ukraine war and the easing of COVID restrictions fuel energy and food price hikes. Barely 2 weeks ago, the British Prime Minister survived a potentially lethal challenge to his leadership. Boris Johnson nearly made it through the Conservative MP's vote of no confidence in the House of Commons, and yet Johnson has decided to take on new challenges instead of talking about the Partygate scandal and his actions during the coronavirus pandemic.
Considering the latest controversies around Johnson, the British Prime Minister seems to be taking full advantage of a strategy known as the dead cat strategy in order to divert media attention away from problems or failures in other areas. Just a week after the vote of confidence, the British Prime Minister and his government are provoking other crises. Johnson says he wants to focus on what the people of the country want. And the first two issues which he has decided to tackle are the controversial matters of changing trade rules for Northern Ireland and flying refugees to Rwanda, both cases that thrust Britain into a nasty web of legal disputes that risk making the country look like an international scofflaw. With his leadership in peril, Johnson summoned his trusted advisors, and among those experts is political strategist Linton Crosby, a master of so-called wedge issues that divide national opinion. Such strategies are typically used to galvanize working-class voters. The most divisive wedge issue is asylum seekers, as Crosby clearly demonstrated in his experience with the Australian premiership, winning him many victories some two decades ago. So it wasn't a coincidence that a few days after their meeting, Home Secretary Priti Patel's floundering plan to export asylum seekers to Rwanda was revived. But at what cost has the British Prime Minister risked turning the UK into a pariah?
The controversy surrounding it is becoming more of a legal battle. We have seen the European Court of Human Rights intervening in the issue based on, you know, filing from some of those affected by the decision, some of the asylum seekers. And I wonder if the UK really became a pariah state under Mr. Johnson, because this is not the first time he is going against international law.
The chartered Boeing 767 booked to take asylum seekers to Rwanda was a fiasco. It didn't take off thanks to a last-minute intervention from the European Court of Human Rights.
The UK has, in essence, thrust itself against the European Court of Human Rights on Rwanda agreement, which stipulates that refugees to Britain will be deported to the African country and receive asylum procedures. A controversial £120 million deal is coming under heavy criticism in regard to its legality.
The British government's first attempt of sending asylum seekers to Rwanda came to a halt on Tuesday after the European Court of Human Rights intervened and forced the UK to abandon the flight. The intervention has, however, drawn frustration from British ministers who insist the plan was lawful. Britain's failed attempt has also led to officials proposing alternatives that would allow the UK to ignore the ECHR. Johnson himself defended the plan, saying it was completely legal.
Every single court in this country said, you know, there was no obstacle that they could that they could see. Nobody in this country, no court in this country, ruled the policy unlawful, which was very, very encouraging.
Johnson described the order by the European Human Rights Court to stop the scheduled deportation of a handful of migrants as a weird last-minute hiccup. The United Nations refugee chief has, on the other hand, called it catastrophic. Following the ECHR's decision, British courts now have to clarify whether this practice is lawful.
When it comes to the issue of asylum seekers being exported by his government out of the UK to the to Rwanda, 1,000 miles away in Africa, that's actually illegal. We have heard this characterization of the issue as illegal from the United Nations, the Human Rights Commission, from multitude of international rights.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and his government have spent much of this week battling with the EU and rowing with the European Human Rights Tribunal while playing down accusations that they are breaking international law and bow to the base of his party. On Monday, Johnson's Foreign Secretary Liz Truss revealed the long-awaited Northern Ireland Protocol Bill, a bill which, if passed, would allow the UK government to unilaterally cancel parts of the Brexit deal he struck with the EU in 2019. 2 days later, the EU reacted by launching legal action against the UK for its failure to implement parts of the protocol to date, while the Vice President of the European Commission stated that there is no legal or policy justification whatsoever for unilaterally modifying an international agreement. That is illegal. But the Prime Minister's willingness to have public spats with large international institutions seems typical of him. The Rwandan deportations and the renewed issue of Northern Ireland just seem to be radicalization of British politics, where Johnson tries to stay in power with new crisis.
That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. Today, arrogant Franz grandeur is broken and nations talk against the US. February 17, 2022. All the activists who had worked in these sectors have contributed to the continuation and perpetuation of the revolution. And of course, we have not done enough and we have shown some negligence. Over the years, there may have been malicious intentions. There may have been some of these things, but great things have also been done. And if it had not been for these cases of negligence, the situation would have been better. I'd like to say that with the movement of the continuation of the revolution, today the revolution is thankfully both alive and productive and generative. When the arrogant front stands against the revolution and against the revolutionary nation of Iran and show great enmity, the reason is that the revolution is alive. If it had not been for the revolution, they would not have had any reason to be so vicious and evil against the Iranian nation.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
What does survival of the revolution mean? It means the attachment of the new generations of the country to the ideals of the revolution. Today, people are attached to the same ideals that the revolution put forward. It means nations' independence, national dignity, national welfare, social justice, the realization of an Islamic society, and ultimately, as I said before, the creation of a new Islamic civilization. These are the great goals of the revolution. Our people today are attached to these goals. If they can do anything that is within their power, they will really do it. That is, the vast majority of the country has this attachment. Now, there may be people who are a little slow to move or do not move at all, but the Iranian nation is, generally speaking, attached to these ideals. The nation is attached, the revolution is alive, and the sign of the survival of the revolution is the enmity of the camp of arrogance, which stems from the insistence of the Islamic Republic on these goals. It is incorrect to say that the revolution has drifted away from its goals. One hears from some individuals that the revolution has strayed from its goals. This is not the case. If the country has strayed from the goals of the revolution, the enemies of the revolution would not have been so hostile to the system. The Islamic Republic and Islamic Iran.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
A new report by the Wall Street Journal reveals that Israel secretly coordinates with the U.S. on many of the airstrikes it carries out in Syria. The report adds that since 2017, Israel has carried out more than 400 airstrikes in Syria and other parts of the West Asia region. It claims that Israeli attacks have been aimed at restricting Iran and its allied forces in Syria. The vast majority of those Israeli airstrikes have been approved by the U.S. Central Command and at the Pentagon. The U.S. aims to ensure that Israel's bombing raids don't interfere with the U.S.-led military campaign in Syria. Many observers believe that the revelation by the Wall Street Journal was rather a confirmation of an open secret policy.
I think, first of all, whenever anyone says that the U.S. is secretly doing this or that with Israel, it's almost naive to say that. Israel is, in essence, an agent of the United States. I know there are people that think it works the other way around. Israel is a Euro-American white settler state that was imposed on Palestine, as people know. Project beginning, I guess, perhaps you say, from the Balfour Declaration in the 20s forward to when the State of Israel, quote unquote, was created. And it's been a military base, basically, from which to secure the oil fields of the area, Iran's, Iraq's, all of it, Syria's, everywhere. The Israeli military, for all of its public relations effort to the contrary, is an agent of the U.S. military, with some nominal French and British input into that. Certainly financial input is not nominal, it's real. But this is a creature of the Pentagon and Langley that behaves in coordination with the policy that is implemented by the United States.
The timing of the Wall Street Journal revelation comes as the Israeli regime has increased its attacks against Syria. Last week, the regime heavily struck Damascus International Airport, which is still not completely up and running. Syrian officials have said on many occasions that U.S. troops in Syria are there to loot the country's resources. Former U.S. President Donald Trump was not embarrassed to frankly say that he kept U.S. troops in Syria for Syrian oil only.
We've kept the oil. We stayed back and kept the oil. Other people can patrol the border of Syria, frankly. And
the fight against Daesh seems to have been a good pretext to maintain U.S. illegal presence in Syria. Syrian officials have also repeatedly called on the United Nations to stop Israel's strikes on the country. But those calls have almost always gone unnoticed behind a couple of verbal admonitions by UN officials. This seems to have emboldened the regime to carry on its attacks with impunity.
After setting loose Daesh and al-Qaeda and 47 other varieties of jihadi on Syria, the U.S. government found itself facing a request from the Syrian government that had, by the way, been twice elected since 2011 by vast majorities of Syrians inside and outside the country. Israel is, you know, a U.S. lapdog. That has lots of advanced weapons. It's a money laundry for money that goes funneled through the Pentagon and Langley. Billions and billions of dollars of money taken from American taxpayers ends up in the hands of arms merchants, all kinds of people through Israel and whatever. And these things are used to inflict misery on the people of the Middle East to the extent that there's any resistance between these people that want to own the resources of that area and the actual ownership of it.
The confirmations of the U.S. approval and coordinations of Israeli attacks in Syria can definitely be seen as rather a public support for regime strikes in Syria, especially at a time when Israel has increased the intensity of its cross-border attacks. Such support would likely embolden the Israeli regime to carry out more attacks in Syria.
Turkey has targeted northern Iraq, killing several people and injuring a number of others. The strike hit the Sinjar Resisting Units, or YBS, a militia affiliated with the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, in Iraq's northern province of Sinjar. Turkey regards the PKK as a terrorist outfit. According to security sources, the strike hit a municipal council building in Snani, a village near the border with Syria. Turkey regularly carries out airstrikes into northern Iraq and has sent commandos to support its offensives. Baghdad accuses Turkey of violating its sovereignty. Turkey has a long-running military campaign in northern Syria against Syrian Kurdish YPG militia. Ankara considers that group as a terrorist organization as well. Ankara is reportedly planning to expand its military operation in northern Syria. President Erdogan has told the parliament Ankara aims to resume its efforts to create a 30-kilometer safe zone along its border with Syria. He has also urged NATO member states to support his country's efforts to establish a safe zone on the border with Syria.
It is crazy to think that the Turks will be fighting American-sponsored troops, and there isn't anybody in the world community that can call them up on the hypocrisy and saying, you are fighting amongst yourselves in a way that could end up in a world war.
Turkey has deployed forces in Syria in violation of the Arab country's territorial integrity. The Syrian Foreign Ministry called on the international community not to work with Erdogan on the lands of other countries to achieve goals that will have catastrophic effects on security, peace, and stability in the region and in the world. Russia also considers Turkey's possible military operation in Syria unwise, as it could escalate and destabilize the situation. Iran also voiced concern about the planned operation, saying the move could complicate the situation even further. In Syria, Turkey conducted three military operations in 2016, 2018, and 2019 that specifically aimed to prevent the formation of politically autonomous regions along the Turkish border controlled by Kurdish-dominated YPG militants. A fourth operation in 2020 in the Idlib region did not specifically target PKK affiliates, but it was in line with Turkey's desire to maintain territorial control and create a buffer zone along the Turkish-Syrian border.
But it's a big problem. It shows Turkey up for what it is, and that Turkey is doing everything in the region purely for their own short-term benefit, and they are quite happy to fight the Kurds and crush the Kurds, and this completely conflicts with the Americans aren't really trying to help the Kurds, as they aren't ever really trying to help anyone apart from themselves, and their short-term allies, the Kurds, are going to end up fighting their other allies, the Turks.
Ankara-backed militants were deployed to northeastern Syria in October 2019 after Turkish military forces launched a long-threatened cross-border invasion in a declared attempt to push YPG fighters away from border areas. Turkey has played a major role in supporting terrorists in Syria ever since a major foreign-backed insurgency overtook the country more than 10 years ago. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and other senior officials have said the Damascus government will respond through all legitimate means available to the ongoing ground offensive by Turkish forces and allied Takfiri militants in the northern part of the war-battered Arab country.
Iran is expanding its diplomatic and economic ties with its neighbors and beyond. On Wednesday, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi hosted his Turkmen counterpart Serdar Berdimuhamedov in Saadabad Palace in northern Tehran. Iran and Turkmenistan signed a set of documents and memoranda of understanding to broaden bilateral cooperation in different fields. 9 MOUs were signed in the meeting to boost cooperation in various fields, including politics, economy, trade, transportation, investment, new technologies, environment, sports, energy, judiciary, education, research, and tourism. This is Berdimuhamedov's first visit to Iran as Turkmenistan's president. He traveled to Tehran in January as the special envoy of Turkmenistan's former president and held talks with Raisi. Iran and Turkmenistan have agreed to set up a major trade center that can facilitate ties between businesses in the two countries amid efforts to deepen economic relations between the two neighbors. The establishment of the Tehran-Ashgabat Trade Center was discussed on Tuesday during a meeting between Iranian Trade Minister Reza Fatemi Amin and Deputy Head of the Cabinet of Ministers of Turkmenistan, Batir Atdayev. On Tuesday, Iran's president hosted visiting Pakistani Foreign Minister Bilawal Bhutto Zardari. During the meeting, Raisi hailed ties between Iran and Pakistan and said Tehran and Islamabad can expand their bilateral trade and business ties to benefit both nations.
I find this most recent flurry of diplomatic activity and state visits to Iran to be highly significant. What this signifies is that clearly Iran, far from being isolated on the world stage, is in fact extending its ties, bilateral ties, both regionally and as well ties to Venezuela in the Western Hemisphere.
And earlier in the week, Iran welcomed Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro and his high-level delegation. Iran and Venezuela have signed partnership agreements in the fields of science, technology, agriculture, oil and gas, petrochemicals, tourism, as well as culture. Raisi hailed the accord as an indication of the two countries' determination to expand bilateral ties despite U.S. and Western pressure. And the Venezuelan president, for his part, lauded the 20-year partnership agreement between Tehran and Caracas, saying the two sides will be able to expand bilateral relationship by consolidating their ties and drawing a clear vision in the next two decades.
As far as the outcome of these visits, this can only be positive for these nations, for most recently Pakistan, whose prime minister visited, for the Turkmen president, and as well for President Maduro. Those nations and national leadership that seeks to maintain sovereignty and independence, especially and particularly from American global economic and military hegemony, will greatly benefit their national economies as well as their populations.
And last month, Iran hosted Tajikistan's President Emomali Rahman. That visit also resulted in the signing of major deals between Tehran and Dushanbe. Since the inauguration of President Raisi's government, Tehran has stressed on the expansion of ties with regional as well as non-regional countries. Raisi's major achievement was his attendance at the Shanghai Cooperation Organization in Dushanbe, where Iran was formally accepted as a new member of the organization. Iran's accession to the SCO will be a major boost to the bloc's influence in the region.
I believe what we're seeing is the relatively exciting and promising, although challenging, beginnings of the complete break from the dollar-based global economic system. I say exciting and promising because this will definitely enable nations that seek to maintain their independence and sovereignty to break from the dollar-based global economic system. However, this is certainly not an easy task and one that comes without costs.
Mainly because Iran's massive transportation network can facilitate regional and international trade. Iran is also expected to benefit economically from the membership in the bloc. The Iranian Customs Office said that Iranian exports to SCO members had increased by 41% year-on-year in the 11 months to late February, reaching nearly $18.3 billion.
But ultimately, we can look forward to the development of actual systems and structures that will enable nations, independent sovereign nations such as Iran, Russia, China, Venezuela, potentially other nations in the region who want to get on board, Turkmenistan, Pakistan, which we were recently talking about, to move towards a system that is not reliant, for example, on SWIFT and that completely bypasses the dollar.
Earlier this year, Iran's president also visited Russia to expand bilateral ties. Tehran and Moscow reached agreements to expand their cooperation in the fields of industry, defense and aerospace sectors, as well as oil and energy. The burgeoning ties between Iran and other countries have foiled plots by the U.S. and its allies to isolate Iran. They also show that sanctions and threats have failed to stop Iran's progress.
After some three decades of a fall in the global stockpile of nuclear weapons, the world seems to be on the brink of witnessing a reverse in the declining trend. The Stockholm International Peace Research Institute's yearly report states that online possessors of nuclear weapons, namely the United States, Russia, the United Kingdom, France, China, India, Pakistan, Israel, and the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, continue to modernize their nuclear arsenals. The arms watchdog, also known as CPRI, says the total number of nuclear weapons declined slightly between January 2021 and January 2022. However, a senior associate with the think tank says there is evidence of change in where the world is headed and warned that this is a very worrying trend. The trend in nuclear weapons worldwide has been witnessing a declining trend for a long time. It is now lower than one-fifth of what it was within the arsenals of the nuclear powers at the top of the Cold War in the 1980s. And now, CPRI's report comes at the height of mixed signals regarding nuclear diplomacy. Earlier this year, the five UN veto powers, including China, France, Russia, the United Kingdom, and the United States, declared their intention to take action against the further spread of nuclear weapons. But the think tank asserted that all five countries had since further expanded or modernized their arsenals.
The United States has attempted to take control as a unipolar power, and it's been a calamity for around the world, actually, for so many countries in so many ways. And for the last two decades, they've been driving forward. They have abandoned the nuclear treaties that were hammered out over the last part of the 20th century.
CPRI reports that Russia and the U.S. possess about 90% of all nuclear warheads in the world, while the watchdog says the number of nuclear warheads in both countries fell in 2021. It states that the decline was mainly due to dismantling of those which the military had already abandoned years ago. CPRI says that out of the total number of global nuclear warheads, an estimated 3,732 were deployed with missiles and aircrafts, and around 2,000 were kept in a state of high readiness, nearly all of which belong to either Russia or the United States. The Russian military doctrine allows the battlefield use of nuclear weapons, and the Biden administration has discussed possible responses. But who is following the path of war more, risking the use of nuclear weapons?
The United States is definitely driving this process. They're driving NATO ever closer to Russia. And I think that when you say the U.S. and its allies, you have to realize that Russia has allies as well. And those alliances are being strengthened by the U.S. aggression that's happening right now. The U.S. aggression in the Middle East has driven Syria and some other country, and Turkey, actually, who are not getting along with each other, but they're both being driven more into Russia and China's orbit and out of the U.S. economic center. And now with NATO pressing up against the borders of Russia, I mean, it's truly a terrible thing to do, and not to acknowledge that anyone has interests except the United States. So of course Russia's going to defend their borders.
Meanwhile, as the West proceeds with its acts of aggression across the globe, it has also ramped up its rhetoric against Iran. This comes as one of the U.S.'s closest allies, Israel, which also possesses nuclear weapons, has made threats against the Islamic Republic. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett claimed that Tehran was drawing dangerously close to producing nuclear weapons. The accusation comes despite Tehran's strong rejection of producing or even considering nuclear weapons. Bennett also called on the global community to ramp up efforts against Tehran, saying Iran's nuclear program won't stop until stopped. The warmongering aspirations of the U.S. and its allies comes while the world seems to be faced with many other challenges. Relations across the globe seem to have deteriorated further at the time when humanity and the planet face an array of profound and pressing common challenges. And while such difficulties could only be addressed by international cooperation, many, including the U.S., seem to be more focused on aggressive policies.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. O Prophet, Allah is sufficient for you and for such the believers that follow you. What an honorable address for the pious believers. What an address of accountability for the pious believers. Honorable, because although Allah, the Blessed and Exalted, suffices and no person has any power vis-a-vis the exalted truth, and all are insignificant, nevertheless, the sublime and almighty Allah has favored the pious believers with the honor of also mentioning them beside his own blessed name in the verse, "For you, O Prophet, God and those who have followed, and the pious believers who have obeyed your call are sufficient."
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi, with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the Quran. In one of his speeches, Imam Khomeini has mentioned that there is no school above the Quran. In this small statement, he has said a lot of things. There are many, many things that are hidden in it. And that is that the only school, the only thought, the only ideology that we need to follow is the Quran, which is the book of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Allah has sent the Quran and he sent it for the guidance of the mankind. He sent it for the mankind, not only for the believers, not only for the Muslims, but the mankind. And therefore he says that it is a clear statement for the mankind. هذا بيان للناس. The word nas has been used, the mankind. Therefore, Allah didn't say that this is a book for Muslims. He said this is a clear statement for the mankind, and there is a guidance in it, and there is an admonition in it. So whoever wants the guidance, whoever wants the admonition, whoever wants the advice, he must look at the Quran. And Quran is something which is a clear statement. It is not confusing. It does not have any hard thing in it. It is a clear statement. It has clear evidences in it. The history that we see, which has been narrated in the Quran, which has been said in the Quran, it is all clearly said. The examples are very clear. Therefore, whoever wants the guidance, whoever wants the advice,
He must follow the teachings of the Quran. And the best school in the world is the school of Quran. The best ideology is the ideology of the Quran. Therefore, there is no school above the Quran. Why? Because the other schools are made of humans. Even when we look at the Christianity or Judaism, this is not the actual religion which was brought by the Jesus Christ or the Prophet Moses and Prophet Abraham. Whereas these are the deviations, and the followers of these prophets, they entered their own ideas or their own explanations and their thoughts into the religion. Whereas Quran is not being changed. This is one of the miracles that for the past 1,400 years, since the Quran is revealed upon the Prophet, since he made his companions writing the verses of the Quran, since that time till now, there is no change in the Quran. And therefore, it is necessary to follow such a school which is above all and which is directly attached to the Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, inshaAllah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay with us.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, in light of the Iranian Foreign Minister's visit to India, we'll assess the opportunities and challenges ahead for the development of ties between the two nations. We'll also take a look at the worldwide protests of the Muslim community to derogatory comments made by BJP officials against the Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and their implications for India.
On the 8th of June, the Iranian foreign minister, accompanied by a high-ranking delegation, visited New Delhi to meet with Indian politicians, trade officials, and other notable dignitaries. During this visit, the two sides held extensive talks discussing various fields of interest, which showcased the willingness of both parties to expand ties on all fronts. Creating a blueprint for long-term cooperation between the two countries is one of the main objectives of this visit, apart from discussing recent global and regional developments, a goal that appears more necessary than ever in the aftermath of the economic stagnation that occurred in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic, is solving conflicts in Europe and the global food and energy crisis.
Looking at historical context, Iran and India have maintained long-lasting ties, but these ties have been subjected to global and regional developments of recent decades, causing a fluctuation in bilateral relations. India is a newly emerging superpower that the IMF predicts will become the third global economic powerhouse by 2025, after the US and China. The requirement for long-term energy supplies as the fourth consumer of oil after China, US, and Russia means it cannot ignore Iran, which holds the world's second-largest reserve of natural gas and the third-largest oil reserves. 2 days before his speech at GlobeSec 2022 in Bratislava, Jaishankar stated, If the US and Europe want to limit other countries' imports from Russia, they must bring Iran and Venezuela as alternative import options back to the table. From another perspective, access to countries in West Asia, Europe, and the Persian Gulf is an important objective for India that can be best achieved through Iran. The visit by the Iranian foreign minister and his accompanying delegation and the talks held with high-ranking Indian officials come at a time when the global food and energy crisis caused by the Russia-Ukraine war is heralding new challenges for India, like many other nations. On the other hand, a balanced approach to foreign policy and mutual political security and economic interests necessitates the furthering of ties between Iran and India if they aim to achieve mutual goals.
India considers Iran a significant supplier of energy and a bridge to reach Afghanistan, West Asia, and Europe. For the Islamic Republic, India is one of the countries that can help Iran achieve its look to the east policy. Meanwhile, shared concerns for security in Afghanistan and Central Asia, along with India's policy to balance relations between the East and the West, have made Iran a focal point in India's global and regional politics.
We can trace India's interest in Central Asia to the economic and cultural exchanges along the ancient Silk Road. These exchanges that include all aspects of politics, economy and culture in conjunction with India-Pakistan's deteriorating ties have arguably made Chabahar port the best or perhaps the only viable access point for India in its attempts to reach Afghanistan and other Central Asian countries. Moreover, access to Europe and increasing India's influence and power in the Persian Gulf and West Asia would prove most difficult without proper cooperation and coordination with Iran. In pursuit of clear geopolitical and geoeconomic gains, especially when it comes to the Chabahar project, the Indian government has inked several cooperation agreements with Iran over the past two decades. The Chabahar port is one of the main variables that can lead to improved economic relations and subsequently the formation of a lasting political link between Iran, India and Afghanistan, a link that New Delhi seems to pursue as one of its priorities in its policies toward the new Iranian government.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Karim Sharara, an Iranian affairs expert from Beirut, Lebanon. Now, Mr. Sharara, welcome to the program. Now, considering furthering political and economic ties can be beneficial to both Iran and India, how do you assess the prospects of cooperation between the two nations?
Okay, I think both countries stand to gain a lot from cooperation with one another. On the one hand, of course, Iran, as President Raisi has said time and time again, is trying to increase its cooperation with its neighboring countries. So on the one hand, you have the relationship with the Axis of Resistance or countries that are that have very strong relations with Iran. So we're talking here about Iraq, Syria, and the strategic depth that Iran has in the region, in West Asia, I mean. And on the other hand, you also have Central Asia, which, I mean, I'm just talking about where Iran is concerned at the moment. So we're talking Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, and of course, we're talking about China. Now, there's a lot we can talk, we can say about China, but as far as India is concerned, India is one of the most important countries in the world right now after China. And of course, it isn't just fine with remaining a super or a very strong regional power close to superpower status in South Asia. Increase its clout in Central Asia. One of the impediments towards that relationship, towards it retaining that status, is Pakistan, on the one hand, and the problems it shares with India. So